From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour is made every day right here in Rochester, where moms buy hats for their kids, aunts take their cats to the vet, and you might just need a map to navigate the Pittsford Wegmans. Okay, I'm overemphasizing my A's here, but that's a defining feature, that flat A, of what we've come to know as the Rochester accent. And whether you live in the city of Rochester or in Buffalo or as far away as Cleveland, you've probably heard variations of this accent. It's a regional one, and its origins date back to the early 19th century. So even if you hear this accent every day, have you ever stopped to think about where it came from or how it might have changed or how it might continue to evolve in the future? A University of Rochester professor is thinking about all this, and she has taken these questions on as part of a major research project. We'll talk about her goals for that project and also about how and why accents and language in general changes. And we'll also read some of your comments on Twitter and email that have been flooding in since this morning, so thank you all for that. I'd like to welcome my guests, Maya Aptakian. Did I get that right?
Yep.
I'm trying. As an assistant professor of linguistics at the University of Rochester. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jane Gatewood, much easier, thank you, is the vice provost for global engagement at the University of Rochester. Welcome back to you.
Thank you.
And I should also mention that you worked on the American Accents floor of the Oxford English Dictionary in a past life. And I know there's a bit more. Tell us about that.
I've also worked on linguistic variety and shifts in late medieval English as well.
So we have a lot to talk about this hour, listeners, and you can join the conversation by calling 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also email the program at connections@wxxi.org, and I'm on Twitter at mmacmedia. And I have to say, Jane and Maya, I am so self-conscious about my A's right now because that's all I hear now that I'm thinking about this topic. So I know the opening of the show is a bit cheeky, but this accent is so recognizable. And let's talk about the origins of it, because Maya, you mentioned as you were coming in, most people don't think about it, but then when they do, some people want to get rid of it. So let's talk about where it came from and how that all came to be.
Well, so, I mean, this is still a hypothesis, but when it was first documented in the 70s, the idea was that potentially it started actually just in this area. So this dialect that is part of the dialect region that encompasses all of the cities around the Great Lakes started in Rochester with the building of the Erie Canal and people moving from different parts of the East Coast of the United States with different East Coast dialects. And the flat A that you talked about is one of the key features, and that basically they came with different patterns for that flat A. That then sort of converged on, well, just let's just make it all sound like eh, right? So for kids who are hearing it, it's complicated to say, well, I should say man, but mad, right? So that across the board, they're saying mad and man, and this becomes now one of the most stereotyped features of the dialect.
So we get the garbage plate and the flat A. Hometown pride. But you were also saying, and Jane, feel free to jump in here as well, is once people start to recognize it, they make judgments about it. And we can talk all about judgments and social pressure about accents. But I had a question from a colleague in the newsroom. How do I get rid of my Rochester accent?
Right. So that was really interesting to me because one of the other key features of this dialect is that for a long time, it seemed to be the case that people either didn't recognize it as being... if you asked people, is there a Rochester accent? They'd say, no, we speak, you know, sort of standard American. And in the last couple decades, it does seem like it's becoming more stereotyped, it's becoming more noticeable, and that if that's the case, maybe that becomes something then that people want to move away from. I don't want to sound like a hick. It depends on who you're talking to, how they characterize it, but I want to sound more general American.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think if we get a little meta here, all an accent is really the way of a group of people talk to one another, right? And so when they're when it's unmarked or unnoticed, that means that group of people, you know, isn't identifying difference, right, within the speech patterns. And so then when you have an accent, we all have accents, we all have linguistic markers that tell others about, you know, where geography, about a number of things. And we change our linguistic markers as well, depending on who we're talking to and what the subject is. And you know, I grew up in the South, and it was pretty common for Southerners of my age group, and I went to college in the mid-90s, to drop accents when you went to college, and to drop accents in formal educational settings, but then pick them back up with family and with friends. And that's really common. So it is interesting now that if individuals are wanting to drop a flat A, you know, that does indicate that, like, you know, possibly that there is something stereotypical happening, yeah. Right?
And that's such a good comparison, too, because right. The Southern accent is one that's been highly stereotyped in the
Correct.
U.S.
Correct. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You want to sound like a hick, you change your diphthongs, right?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what a diphthong is in case people
okay.
don't know.
a blend of two vowels. Yeah.
Right.
So you can make them long or short, but Southerners usually invert, right? So they might make what we would say, they might take a monophthong like pit, P-I-T, and say pit, and make it a diphthong. So make mm-hmm. it sound like two vowels, and then pit. There you are.
So how far, Maya, would you need to travel outside of this region? Because this, let's talk about the inland Northern American English. That's what this accent is actually part of. How far does that spread regionally?
So, I mean, we're close to the eastern edge of it, really somewhere between Syracuse and Albany, probably closer to Syracuse, is about the edge where you move from inland north into what's called western New England. At the other side, you have to go pretty far west, right? So we're going as far west as eastern Wisconsin.
And then individual words differ among those different regions. So I think there was an example I read in a paper you sent about what's called a tree lawn in Cleveland. I'm trying to okay. remember. Jump in, Jane, if you remember what this example is. But, well, let's use pop. That's a better example. Mm-hmm. It's more accessible. So some people here say pop, some say soda, some say Coke. So let's talk about how individual words differ in different regions and how that happens.
Yeah, well, soda and pop is so fun here because I think we are actually right on the line, what's called the isogloss in a dialect atlas, where people in Syracuse use soda and people in Buffalo pretty consistently use pop. And people in Rochester, when I ask people, it seems to be pretty split, which I find really interesting.
So, again, just another kind of backstory. Growing up in the South, we called everything Coke, right? Mm-hmm. So a soda, any sugary beverage that has carbonated water is a Coke. And I'm going to make that a hard... But my family that was from the Detroit area, you know, called everything pap, you know, and they used to like to say, oh, well, Jane has an accent, you know, and they never heard their own. So, yeah, those are useful markers.
Great debates have happened over Coke versus soda versus pop, and friendships have been ended. But let's stick within this region. And Maya, I know you sent some audio clips over that we can listen to sort of hear the differences within the region itself. So we'll start, even though a lot of us have heard this before, we'll start with the Rochester accent. Let's listen.
We have a lot of, I guess, headquarters. We have Bausch & Lomb is here, and Xerox is pretty big. I think it's a pretty big corporate city. It's got a lot of corporations, but like in the suburbs that I live in, they're just real nice. I think all the people are generally nice. We have a pretty bad inner city. I mean, downtown is pretty nice in the center, but around it, there can be pretty bad city. Yeah, it's run down in some places. That mm-hmm. gets pretty bad.
Where would you go shopping?
I go to a different suburb called Henrietta. They have big malls there, and they have another mall in Irondequoit, which is another suburb.
Irondequoit. Our engineer Rob is laughing behind the glass, not making fun of anyone, just recognizing this. So very flat A, very distinguishable flat A.
And then also you pointed out the other key one in Irondequoit, right? That's Rochester. That's what we call the short O.
The short O, mm-hmm. right. Jeremy on Twitter says, just listen to the Lisa's Liquor Barn commercial. And that's something that other listeners have called in about as well. So if we move further west, we hit Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. And that sounds a little different. I found this clip really interesting. So here's what we can listen to from Ann Arbor.
What's another word for pigs?
hog.
Yeah.
Or
now,
a hog.
Right. Now, how do you say that word?
Depends on which one you're talking about. There's some kinds that they pronounce them as hogs. Some kinds they pronounce as hogs. It's like a different breed. Neighbor down the street, he's a hog farmer, and he calls them hogs. Okay. Now, he also says there's a breed that they call hogs and hogs.
Jane, you're nodding in agreement. What did you think about that clip?
There are a lot of different ways to pronounce hogs and dogs.
Maya, what was the intent behind gathering that clip?
Well, I liked that clip because he picked out, again, that short O and mm-hmm. gave examples of two different ways of pronouncing it. And what was funny to me was the thing that I would think would be native for him, saying hog. That's what he is. He's a hog farmer. Well, my neighbor down the street, he's got hogs, which I thought was just a really funny distinction between those two. But yeah, I mean, Ann Arbor is also part of that, the Inland North dialect region. I should point out all these clips come from the Atlas of North American English, and you can listen to all these online. But these were recorded in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. So I think that some things may have changed since then.
Mm-hmm. Now let's head to New York City. This is our last clip. And let's see how that's a bit different. Let's listen.
Single-family homes, strips of stores, you know, what we call the Avenue. That would be Liberty Avenue. Uh-huh. You have a grocery store and the drugstore and, you know, places you can walk to do your shopping. Basically, all neighborhoods are like that in Queens.
So, very different. But, Maya, what are the major differences between the three that we've heard here? And you can get geeky about it.
Well, I mean, I picked the New York clip to play. I don't know that anybody in Rochester really needs to be convinced of this, but to demonstrate that the Rochester speaker sounds a lot more like the Ann Arbor speaker than like the New York City speaker, right? Which is, so this dialect region is vast and spreads, but doesn't spread east, right? And again, I don't know how much we need to convince anybody from Rochester that we don't sound like New York City, but I think that clip demonstrates it pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Jane?
I mean, I think that the varieties are clear. I would love to hear a little bit more about the assemblage of the A's that your sort of hypothesis of you know, I think that's really compelling and really interesting that, you know, you had all of these different types of immigrants with different likely foreign accents, right? Foreign speech patterns potentially, but definitely different regional speech patterns migrating. And that's also could account for some of the varieties in New York speech as well, mm-hmm. right? You know, where do you think you're going to go with that?
I mean, that piece isn't so much, that's not my hypothesis.
Yeah.
But one thing I'd like to do, I mean, one of the reasons I want to start this project is since the 1970s mm-hmm. and these 10 to 20 speakers who were recorded in Buffalo, Rochester, and Chi-Lai, nobody's been back to record speakers in Rochester and see what exactly the Rochester accent is and to what extent are people still using this Northern City shift. Do we see generational differences? What has the effect of economic changes in the city had? Those are all the things I'm interested in looking at further.
It would also be interesting to look at I like to think about how geography, either real or imagined, changes how people speak and changes how linguistic communities emerge and form. And it would be really interesting to get some historical recorded speech of, you know, the inner city before the inner loop was created, after the inner loop was created, and then now that it's being, you know, maybe wait 10 years and look at the, you know, are there any distinctions there? Because language often tends to change when you, or at least the speech patterns do when a group of people is removed, yep. you know, or if there's a type of separation that is sustained between populations, that's why we get regional varieties, of course.
Yep. If you have those historical recordings, please tell me.
I will have a think on that.
So Maya, how do you go about conducting the research itself? I imagine when someone realizes they're being studied, they might, I'm thinking about how I'm speaking very carefully right now. So how does that impact your research and affect true results?
Yeah, so as much as possible, we try to get people to forget the fact that the recorder's there. And there are a number of different ways of trying to do this. One really common way in my field is to, first of all, have a long enough interview that people are focusing less on the recorder, and that you ask them the kind of questions that get them really excited or get them angry or get them remembering something, get them thinking about their childhood, so that they're not, they're in that moment instead of in the moment thinking about their language. Another way that one thing that I would like to do is have people in family groups so that they're talking to each other more than they're talking to me.
What about social media and YouTube? Does that play a role now? There seems to be so much content out there where you don't have to interact with someone on an individual level, but still study them objectively.
Yeah, so I mean, with respect to what Jane was saying, right, you talk like who you talk to, and with more separation, you get more dialect diversity. I think the role of social media is really an interesting one. And actually just the role of media in general, because for a long time, the received wisdom in our field was that the media didn't make a huge difference because we were listening to the same media, but dialects were continuing to diversify. One thing I think is interesting now is that we're actually probably listening to less of the same media because there's so much more out there. So what effect that has, I mean, the media is such a huge question in terms of language change, and it's one that's kind of hard to pin down, I think.
Mm-hmm. Reading some of your comments from Twitter, Dan says, I have a partial Rochester accent since my parents are from Long Island. Talk about a mashup. Corey says, I have something. Grew up in Connecticut, close to New York City, but Rochesterian since college. I often get asked what my accent is. Elle says, when I lived in Florida, I asked someone where I could buy a bagel, and they had no idea what I was asking for. There are bagel shops in Florida, so they must use a different word for bagel in Florida. I'm assuming that is related to our Coke soda conversation.
Maybe a different pronunciation.
Yes, maybe a different pronunciation, absolutely. But Maya, you've mentioned that Florida is a case study for accents, because the further south you go, the accent changes, or there's less of an accent.
I was talking. Well, so to some extent, well, and Jane probably knows more about this than I do, exactly where the southern shift ends, but it's certainly somewhere in northern Florida, because once you get to South Florida, you have more New Yorkers than you do native Floridians, so they're not going to sound like they're from the south, right?
Correct. I would say it's probably a little bit around Gainesville, Jacksonville area. That so the northern part of Florida is still more agrarian. It's coastal south, and parts of it more inland are more like South Georgia. But again, that there are more New Yorkers in South Florida and more Latin Americans in South Florida. So there's a you know, Florida is a peninsula. There's a lot of coastal land. So there's just more influx of different people from different parts of the country that go there. So Florida is a particularly odd. But a lot of coastal regions, actually, especially in the South, have pretty unique accents. The Gullah accent on coastal Georgia, and then the New Orleanian accent is its own. It sounds more like New York than the South.
Let's talk about what actually makes how an accent can be formed. So there are a number of factors that weigh into that, and just based on what you've sent for me to read. Race, social class, age, gender, how do all of these things come together? And what do you think is the most important piece, if there's one, in all of those factors?
So, I mean, I think those things are actually more related to how a dialect is maintained, right? So that in what we've been talking about in terms of how a dialect is formed, these are all the things that have come up. It has to do with settlement patterns, who got there first, what the majority of the population, where the majority of the population came from, who they're in contact with, right? So, you know, talking about South Florida having a lot of Latin Americans, for example. And these other things like race and class and gender have to do with the fact that you talk more like who you talk to, right? So that partly it's just that when you have, for example, racial segregation in a city, speakers are less likely to sound like each other because they're less likely to be talking to each other. the other piece of that is the fact that language also serves as an identity marker. And there are things, I hope that for as many people who are telling you, how do I get rid of my Rochester accent? There are also people saying, yeah, I have a Rochester accent and I'm proud of it, right?
There are, yes. Among them, Rachel on Twitter. Let's see if I can. Here we go. Yep, it's great, she says. And Matt says, damn proud of it. So yes, yes.
So that's a piece of it as well, right, is sometimes people want to lose particular features or want to lose their accent. But to a large extent, we want to talk like our family and talk like the way we grew up speaking and the things that we identify with.
Mm-hmm. Matt, who is originally from Hoboken, wants to jump in. Oh, I'm sorry. It's Michael. Hi, Michael. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. So I grew up in Hoboken, New Jersey. I've been up here for 40 years, so it's been, I'm pretty well adapted. But I grew up in Hoboken, and we kind of talk like, you know, like Frank Sinatra and those people. And then, but right up the road, my cousin grew up in Hoboken, but then moved out when she was a kid. And in Hackensack, New Jersey, they sound so different, and we're talking 15 miles away. And they kind of, they shorten their A's, they Hackensack, and it's just very different. When I'm in a room with her, I feel like I'm in another world. She's fun, but she's got a weird accent.
Thanks, Michael.
So I wanted to know what the difference is. Now, I know, and Hoboken is different than New York City, which is right across the river, and Hackensack is different than Hoboken, and we're so close together. What is it about being so close but being so different in terms of accent?
Great, great question. Thank you, Michael. Jane and Maya.
Well, I would imagine that, you know, I can't speak with any authority about the distinctions between Hoboken, Hackensack, and the like, but I'm going to make a reasonable speculation that there are barriers there. They're either real or imagined between those groups. So it could have been, again, settlement patterns. It could have been transportation issues. It could have been any number of things that created a separation between those language communities. Again, an outsider might not hear them, right? So an outsider might not hear those small distinctions, but people who are from a region are often going to hear small shifts. Do you want to?
Yeah. Well, and the real or imagined part is important as well, right? Because some of those boundaries don't have anything to do necessarily with there being an actual border or boundary or lack of transportation, but people think of themselves as being different and differentiate themselves using language, which is something that we do.
Mm-hmm. There's so much about identity and also values judgment that comes into this. And I'd like to talk about that a lot during our second half of the hour. Just getting back to reading more of your feedback that keeps pouring in via Twitter. When we asked the question, describe the Rochester accent, what are its main features? Rachel wrote, pronunciation of documentary. It's like documentary instead of documentary. And also elementary is another word. That's how I say it. Is that a feature of
sedimentary?
Yeah. Sedimentary.
There's a class of those words.
So emphasis on the...
And that, actually, the fun thing about that is actually pretty local, right? So that really is Western New York and not part of this broader dialect region.
Mm-hmm. Rachel says that's the only place, meaning Rochester, I've noticed it. It's unique from some other cities that experience the upper Midwest vowel shift. So... I say documentary. And now I'm very sensitive to that as well. So while I'm in my head, let's go to break so I can recover. Our shortest break, our only break of the hour. When we come back, we'll talk more about the Rochester accent and also about how language changes in general. We'll talk about code switching and values judgments. I have a number of questions about that. And listeners, you can weigh in, share your experiences and stories and questions. The phone number here is 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. More connections next. I'm Megan Mack. Friday on The Next Connections, what does it mean to live sustainably, and how can we achieve it? A new book called Living Well Now and in the Future tackles that question. We'll talk to one of the authors. Then in our second hour, what do The Catcher in the Rye, Harry Potter, and 50 Shades of Grey have in common? Well, they're all on the list of banned or challenged books. We'll talk about Banned Books Week with our guests and with you. That's Friday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, filling in for Evan Dawson today. Listeners, if you are waiting on the phone lines, be patient with us. We're just a little short-staffed. We will get to your calls as soon as we can, so just hang on the line there. I see almost every phone line is lit up. We are talking about the Rochester accent and accents in general and how language changes. My guests today are Maya Aptakian, an assistant professor of linguistics at the University of Rochester. Welcome back.
Thanks.
And Jane Gatewood, Vice Provost for Global Engagement at the University of Rochester as well. Welcome.
Thank you.
So back to some questions about, we were talking during the break about how people really identify with their own particular accent. And I was looking at a tweet from Miriam who says, "There is no such thing as a Rochester accent. Our pronunciation of the English language is perfect." So we were talking during the break about how people form their identities and really just sometimes really value their accent. So let's talk about that, Maya. How is that a factor in your research?
Well, one piece of it, so she's demonstrating what had been, so allegedly, for example, the pronouncing Dictionary of American English used Inland North speech, so this dialect region, as the broadcast standard for radio hosts in the 1950s. So I think for a long time there was this idea that something in the Midwest was proper American English. And so speakers here were not largely aware of the accent. It wasn't stereotyped in other parts of the country the way the Southern accent is, or New York or Boston. And so there wasn't a lot of awareness of it. And consequently, maybe people weren't self-conscious about it either.
Mm-hmm. But we do make values judgments about
yes.
accents. And there,
yes.
let's talk about code switching. So I know you've written about how one of the major myths that sociolinguistics like to talk about is that while language can't or it shouldn't be static, but one dialect is not superior to another. And I think that comes up many times with African American vernacular English. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. And I have a story that I'd like to share that happened here and hear your thoughts on that. So let's talk about just those values judgments, especially as it relates to that particular dialect.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that happens all the time. It's first of all, we identify people by how they speak, and then we consequently make judgments about them as well. And the negative judgments or the negative stereotypes that we associate with a way of speech are closely related to negative stereotypes we have about a group of people that uses that variety. And this can be obviously extremely detrimental in a number of ways. And so one of the things that sociolinguists have been trying to do really for the last 50 years is at the very least demonstrate that any of these varieties are equally systematic, that they are all that all language has variation, that there's no reason that one dialect should be thought of as better than another, except that it happens to be spoken by a group of people who's in power, right? So there's nothing that makes that standard dialect inherently any better.
So a great example is the word ask. So some people pronounce it with A-S-K, some pronounce it AX, like A-X. And I think many times students, especially in school, and particularly students of color, are told that that's not proper English, but that is not true. Correct, Maya?
Well, no. I mean, well, so one thing that I like to tell all my linguistic students in intro classes is that those two varieties, Askian and Axian, Jane probably knows more about this than I do, but those two varieties have been around and in variation since at least Old English. And in fact, I believe it's the case that Askian was the preferred variant for some period of time at least.
Possibly. I don't know off the top of my head. I worked on pronouns.
In any case, the point being that those two variants have been around for a long time. And again, nothing inherently better about one over the other, except that one just ended up sort of, you know, I mean, we assign value to variants, to dialects that have nothing to do with anything about the structure of the dialect. They have to do with our associations with the people who speak them.
So how can we remove that stigma? That's a big systematic change. Maybe that's too big of a question for this hour, but when we have educational institutions, the media,
yep.
pushing, you know, what's
movies,
considered, Hollywood,
Disney,
absolutely,
yep.
pushing what's correct, quote unquote, and what's not,
yep.
how can we overcome that challenge?
Well, I think one thing that we can do is at least start with raising awareness about the fact that, you know, what I said earlier, there's no inherently superior dialect to another, right? And raising awareness about the systematicity of different dialects. At an institutional level, what I would like to see and what I try to do to the extent I can in my classes and so on is the acceptance of different varieties in contexts where they might have been not have been accepted before, right? So in my class, as much as I can, I try to have students writing in their own dialect, in their vernacular form of English. The problem with that, of course, is that that may not be accepted elsewhere. And so there, you know, I know a lot of teachers will say, but I have to teach my students how to use standard English because otherwise it's not going to be accepted elsewhere, right? And I think that's one, but that is one of the major things that we could work to change.
Jane, did you want to jump in?
It'll be a long story about Middle English, so I'll spare you right now.
Okay, we can follow up on the podcast about that. Okay, listeners on the phone, thank you for being patient. We'll start taking some of your calls, and if you're still waiting, be patient with us. We will get to as many as we can. And first up is Nancy in Rochester. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. It's a very interesting presentation today. I have a couple of comments and would love your feedback on it. I have a sister who relocated from the Rochester area over to the Boston area, and she has acquired a wonderful Bostonian accent. And I was wondering if you could comment on the acceptance of a new environment accent and then the use of that accent and incorporating that into your everyday vernacular.
Great. Thank you, Nancy.
Yeah, so I mean, this topic of change, how much you can change over your lifespan. I'd be curious to know how old she was when she moved. But I, to a large extent, what the language that we use is pretty much determined at a pretty young age, right? So learning a second dialect is very similar to learning a second language. It's difficult, and it's not the same as learning your first language or dialect, which is fairly easy for most people. But people do change over their lifespan, and I think one of the interesting things to think about is their motivation for doing so, what it takes to be able to do it plausibly, right? So I'd be curious whether Boston speakers also think she has a Boston accent or whether it only sounds that way to her Rochester relatives, for example.
And I would imagine that she's probably picking up aspects of the register here. There are probably slight shifts that she's undertaking and that anyone undertakes when they go into a new environment. You do make kind of small adaptive shifts, but making a full transition is challenging. It's hard work, and it's often a conscious choice as opposed to the more unconscious adaptive use of new terms, new inflection patterns, just to fit in into that environment.
Mm-hmm. Up next on the phones is Remy in Rochester. Hi, Remy.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
So both my parents were immigrants, and growing up, I mean, to me, they always sounded like they were speaking normal English, but when friends would come over, and even later in life, everybody would ask, where are your parents from? They all heard an accent, which I never heard.
Okay, I'll let our guest jump in.
Yeah, I mean, this is related to the same thing, right? So he grew up with this natively. The interesting thing, of course, is that for most children of immigrants, they sound more like their peers, as do all of us, more like your peers than you do like your parents. Mm-hmm. But presumably that also is something that he could shift into. So he acquired it natively as well, right? So that it doesn't sound like an accent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Remy, I had the same phenomenon. I had my mother had a northern accent, and I couldn't hear it, but all of my friends could. Yeah. So
yeah. You couldn't hear it at
all? I couldn't hear it.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Remy, does that answer your...
Thanks.
Sure. Thank you. We have an email that just came in from Vicky, which is a question I actually have been thinking about as well. She says, Please ask your guest about the old school Hollywood accent originally championed by Edith Skinner in the 20s. She says, I saw Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep on a talk show together in the early 80s, and they were poking fun at the way they both speak with an accent that exists only on a mythical island halfway between England and the U.S. They said they were taught this accent in elocution classes at Juilliard. I was in my teens at the time and became aware of the nasal Rochester accent that I had. I purposely learned to pronounce my vowels differently and have always found it amusing when I'm traveling and people have no idea where in the U.S. I am from. And she signs it Victoria in Rochester. So thank you for that, Vicky. But yes, that old school Hollywood long, how would you describe it? See if you can mimic it for people who may not know what we're talking about.
So the sort of Katharine Hepburn, you know, well, you know, it's sort of a,
it sounds a bit English, but, but
it's
not
R-less, right? So that's one key feature, which, I mean, interestingly enough, at that time, that was a prestigious feature. Mm-hmm. And sometime after World War II, being R-less was no longer a prestigious thing to do, right? So those accents now in New York and Boston are stereotyped. And in fact, young speakers in Eastern New England are very rarely R-less, right? So that's one of the things. And then the other one is what we call the bath-trap split. So bath and trap, right? Mm-hmm. Which again, most young speakers in Eastern New England no longer do that, but Katharine Hepburn did. I mean, and so a few of those actors were natively from Eastern New England, but many of them, just like Dustin Hoffman, learned it, right?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think just a little anecdote, once sound came into cinema, a lot of movie stars lost their jobs, right? And that's, you know, commonly known, but a big reason was that they had, you know, accents that were deemed unacceptable for, you know, popular consumption.
Yeah, you remind me of Louise Brooks, who was a big silent film star, and she was from Wichita. And when the talkie started, producers were like, we cannot have people hear your voice. And she did not work in talkies except for, well, a few films that very few people have seen, probably Jack Garner, are among the only people. Yeah. Up next on the phones is Darren in Pittsburgh. Hi, Darren.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Go ahead.
So I have three questions in particular to the Rochester accent. I'm actually in a suburb of Rochester, and it even seems to change within suburbs, but why do we not typically say, pronounce the T's, or some suburbs not pronounce T's, as in mittens instead of mittens, flat A, so we usually say plaza rather than plaza, and then the emphasis on syllables seems to be a little different, so instead of insurance, it's insurance, and I'm wondering how that relates to kind of a size of population, or whether it's more ethnicities coming together, and that's it.
Well, thanks, Darren.
Dropping the middle T is actually a common feature of American English. So it's pretty common across regions for people to say, instead of 20, to say 20. And instead of, you know, a word like Atlanta, they might say Atlanta. So that dropping of that mid-consonant T, I would say, is probably not distinctly regional or distinctly North Inland. It is a common feature of American English. It's not a common feature of British English. So that piece, I don't know if there's a distinction there, but changing the way that pronunciation and stress occurs, American English has a lot more variety of stress patterns than does, say, British English. British English puts more stress on the first syllable of nearly every word, and that's just a common pattern of British English. And again, American English, we don't have this received pronunciation, so there's a lot more variety. And maybe I don't know if you want to speak to some of the stress patterns or...
Again, I mean, I do think that does vary regionally to some extent, right? If you think about guitar versus guitar, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes some of those changes are actually sort of fixing, in a sense, what's an exceptional stress pattern in American English, right? Where we got final stress on a lot of words from words borrowed from French, and actually in English those two syllable words should have initial, I mean, should, right? But the regular pattern is to have initial stress. So some of these things that we see is that, and again, you know, the reason that they get stereotyped is has to do with speakers reacting to each other more than the language itself.
Mm-hmm. Up next on the phones, which continue to ring, is Ed in East Rochester. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I was calling to follow up on what the woman said about her sister moving to Boston. Okay. I moved to Rochester when I was 28 years old. I'm now 59. I was born and raised in Brooklyn, and about a dozen years after I moved up here, I started getting a lot of people asking me when I met them if I was from Boston. Now, I've spent a grand total of about 6 hours of my entire life in Boston. So it always had me scratching my head when people would ask me that question. And I still, it's only been about the last 5 years or so that people have stopped asking me that.
Okay.
So debate should not really a question.
No, that's okay. I'll let our guest
respond. Did you move from? Sorry, I missed that.
I moved from Brooklyn. I lived in Brooklyn until I was 25, and then my last 3 years I lived in Queens with my wife.
Okay. But people thought you were from Boston.
No, when I moved up here to Rochester about a dozen years after I moved here, I was about 40 at the time, people started asking me if I was from Boston.
Right.
I wonder whether some of that, I haven't heard it yet in your speech, but whether some of that was not being R-less, whether you dropped some of your R's, so to speak. Which I think is sometimes associated with Boston, even though it's also used in New York.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. People have stopped asking me that about 5 years ago. So
okay.
I self-conscious effort to try to change my accent.
Oh, back to that. Okay, thanks, Ed. Let's talk about that for a second, because I don't know if we ever really addressed the question. Was from my colleague Beth Adams, and she said, "How do I get rid of my Rochester accent?" So, how does anyone get rid of an accent without hiring a vocal coach? What do you do on your own if you really do want to change the way you speak?
I mean, I think you have to listen. The way you learn another language, right, is you immerse yourself in that other language. So the way you learn a different way of speaking and different speech patterns is you immerse yourself very consciously in those other speech patterns. And so it's going to be, you know, you can't change your family. Do you want to talk to your family? I mean, this is just something that it seems awkward and arthritic, perhaps, and probably unnecessary. But I don't want to pass judgment. But it, you know, I think that if you really do, my accent started to shift a little bit when I first went to university and then when I moved abroad. And so it will shift when I'm in different places. So you really do, I think part of it is immersion. And then I think you have to ask, are you up for that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Up next on the phones, Patrick in Rochester. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. I don't know if it's still in vogue, but I have read and heard that at the beginning of the broadcast era, a radio broadcast, that since Chicago was between the coast, both, you know, east and west coast, that the pronunciation of the things there, where most of the broadcasting was done, became sort of the accepted or acceptable American accent. It was just because of, you know, the physically of getting across the country, and that what that was for announcers became what people talked. Is that still valid, or is that out passé? Or it seemed to make sense. I've read this at the years and years ago, but I'm just wondering if it's still au courant.
Okay, thanks, Patrick.
Sure.
Jane's looking to Maya. So.
Well, Jade and I were just talking about this earlier,
okay.
Partly because we were talking about how in the U.S., and Jane can talk about the comparison with Great Britain, where we don't have, you know, the BBC radio hosts used to get provided a very specific pronouncing dictionary of RP, received pronunciation, although the BBC has recently made the very interesting decision to not only have radio hosts speaking RP, right?
Right.
And in the U.S., I don't think that there's an exact analogy, although there is. I mean, I do think it's the case. So I have heard that the Inland North speech was provided as the standard for broadcast for radio hosts. Which I think is part of what leads to this ideology of Midwest or Inland North, Great Lakes cities speech as being ideal American speech or accentless American speech.
Jane, did you want to add anything?
No, I mean, I think that the BBC has historically had a guide of broadcast English, and Maya's right to say that it has gotten more diverse and more various of late, particularly given the phenomenon of world English or global English. Mm-hmm.
Up next on the phones, Elaine in Rochester. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, I am a Rochesterian by birth and have a question that is not sure if it's regionalism or if it's laziness in general. My maiden name begins with the letter W, and what I notice is that most people, when they're spelling something out, they say W instead of W. And given the station being WXXI, I also notice that most of the announcers are prone to the W slide. And if there's any comment on that, whether it's a regionalism or just general elocution laziness across the world, across the nation.
Well, the question of laziness is actually kind of a great one for two reasons. One, because, as language changes, one reason or one motivation seems to be ease of articulation, right? So we do kind of, it's common for sound changes to move in the direction of things being easier to pronounce. That said, we still all have to communicate with each other, so we do need to maintain distinction between sounds in order to communicate, right? The other piece of this, though, is that a lot of times, I think there are judgments made about different varieties, and people will make it about themselves. I'm just being lazy if I use this pronunciation. When there's no, for example, when you say run-in instead of running, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's just laziness. And in fact, again, those are two variants that have been around for centuries. And there's no particular reason to think that it's lazy in the sense of a conscious decision to not really speak properly, right?
Is Mary still...
Laziness isn't a conscious decision.
Mary, let me ask you.
Okay, fair enough.
Mary, how do you pronounce the word spelled K-N-I-G-H-T?
The opposite of day. How do you pronounce that word?
But spelled with a K.
Night.
Right. So in Middle English, it was likely pronounced knicked.
I'm just saying
that's we tend to drop things to Maya's point. We tend to drop G's or drop, compound consonants and the like to make it a little bit easier. And I do think that.
But I think
you're drawing the simile to the W.
Yeah. But I think the answer is yes, in the sense you mean it, laziness, not regionalism.
There we go.
All right.
Thank you, Elaine. A question from Valerie on email. I grew up not in Rochester. Oh, she grew up not in Rochester, but she grew up pronouncing M-E-R-R-Y, M-A-R-R-Y, and M-A-R-Y differently. And she says many people do not and cannot hear the differences. I always find that curious. Can your guests comment on that?
There are a lot of those regionally. In Southern English, often the words O-U-R, our, and A-R-E.
I do that all the time.
A-R-E, are often, homophones. I think why does this happen? Maya, do you want to?
Well, I mean that particular.
One?
So if I say those three words they're all going to sound exactly the same, which we'll just demonstrate, you know, so it's Mary, Mary, and Mary, but it could be Mary, Mary, and Mary, right? And that is one of the, so American dialects are actually defined on these different vowel patterns, right? And that's one of the key ones that distinguishes different American dialects. It does lead to a lot of potential misunderstandings when you have speakers from different dialect regions, right? Who are you talking about, right? Is it A-A-R-O-N or E-R-I-N, which for me are exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's a comment from Mary, M-A-R-Y. She says, I studied in Austria with 50 students from across the U.S. We lived in dorms with native speakers, and the Austrians often said they understood my English best. As a foreign language teacher, I'd encourage my high school students to speak, as long as they were comprehensible, yay. Now, if your career is media, other clarity of speaking must apply. So it's, as you were saying before, Jane, it's immersion. So speak. If you're trying to learn a foreign language, if you're trying to change, or Beth Adams, get rid of your Rochester accent, immerse yourself in one at which you seem to prefer. We are almost out of time. I just want to bring up a newsy story that I came across earlier this morning. This month, Merriam-Webster added 250 new words and definitions to the dictionary. And Maya, you were on our show last year when we talked about, or maybe earlier this year when we talked about new words. And froyo was one of the words, troll, meaning to harass or criticize someone, especially online. Is that all part of language changing, how we embrace new words and add them to the dictionary? Both of our guests are nodding. Very quickly, 15 seconds each.
Yes. Yeah. So words, and in fact, words are easier to change. So for Beth Adams wanting to change her accent, she can start with using soda instead of pop, right? Because it's much easier to change the words that you use than the way you pronounce them.
Mm-hmm. Great. I'd like to thank my guests, Jane Gatewood and Maya Avtakian from the University of Rochester, having a lot of fun with us this afternoon talking about the Rochester accent. Thank you to everyone who called in and wrote in. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of your comments, but keep using those accents. I'm sure we'll talk about this again in the future. My thanks to Rob Braden, Tiana Mignon, Audrey Sample, our intern, and thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.